Hello and welcome to Gin and Spooks. I'm Laura.
I'm Emma.
And what are we talking about today, Emma?
Necrophilia. Don't know why I'm so excited for that.
No.
I don't know why I'm so buzzing.
It's like it's one of those topics that can be kind of quite almost juicy with the gory details, but then it's also like listener discretion is very much advised because it's horrific at the same time.
Yeah.
And what are we drinking today, Emma?
A cocktail that I've just made up before I went to bed one night, as you do, called Dead Man at Sunrise, which is Dead Man Fingers rum, pineapple juice, passion fruit juice, mango juice, topped with cranberry.
Yes. And it tastes like pop.
It does. I'm on my third one already.
Yes. Because, of course, you have to drink Dead Man's Fingers rum when you're talking about dead people, obviously.
I see dead people.
I've never seen that film, you know.
No, I haven't, but I know the ending because...
Oh, yeah, everyone.
People talk about it all the time.
It's one of those films I don't think I'd ever watch just because the ending's ruined.
Yeah. Well, that's like the main twist, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, if you already know it. But then again, it might be just a good film in general, but...
Yeah, maybe, but I just don't have any interest in watching it, really.
Yeah.
Anyway, did you want to go first? Have you got some facts?
Yes, I've got some history about necrophilia.
Ooh.
Some science.
I love science.
Can't go wrong with a bit of science.
Science, babe.
So there are some big words in here.
I'm looking forward to
this. This may take a while. okay, so... Necrophilia, also known as necrophilism, necrolagnia, necrocoitus or necroclesis, and thanatophilia, is sexual attraction towards or a sexual act involving corpses.
Yes.
As you do. So, in the ancient world, sailors returning corpses to their home, country were often accused of necrophilia. Accounts of necrophilia in history are sporadic, though written records suggest the practice was present within ancient Egypt. Herodotus, that's how I'm going to say it, Herodotus writes in the histories that to discourage intercourse with a corpse, ancient Egyptians left to seize beautiful women to decay for 3 or 4 days before giving them to the embalmers.
Ooh.
Herodotus also alluded to suggestions that the Greek tyrant Periander had defiled the corpse of his wife, employing a metaphor, Periander baked his bread in a cold oven.
Oh! Baked his bread in a cold oven! Oh, that's gross.
acts of necrophilia are depicted on ceramics from the Moqui culture, which reigned in northern Peru from the 1st to the 8th century CE. Or is that meant to be BC? CE.
CE.
A common theme in these artifacts is the masturbation of a male skeleton by a living woman. Hititi law from the 16th century BC through to the 13th century BC explicitly permitted sex with the dead.
Oh, so it was legal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grim bastards.
Do you ever wonder, sorry, a bit of a tangent, but there's all these things that were legal back then that we're like, oh my God. Do you think that there's things that we do now that in the future they're going to be like, oh my God, I can't believe that was legal?
Probably. I mean, it makes sense not to obviously have sex with a dead corpse because you can get like illnesses and what's the rash that you can get? You can get a rash as well. That you can like spread onto other people. Like it's basically like an STI that you can get from like shagging corpses.
That's gross. I don't know the name of it.
I want to say it's like beetle rash, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Say it 3 times, then beetle rash will appear.
Oh God. Anywho, Renaissance Italy, following the reputed moral collapse brought about by the Black Death and before the Roman Inquisition, the Counter-Reformation literature was replete with sexual references. These include necrophilia, as in the epic poem Orlando Innamorato by Matteo Maria boy Crado, first published in 1483. So, classification of necrophilia. So, there are 8 classifications. So, class number one
number one is
your role players.
Okay.
So, people who get aroused when pretending their partner is dead during sexual activity.
I'm sorry, but if you're ever okay with your partner's fantasy, like sexual fantasy being when you're dead, like, I'm not trying to kink shame, but come on, that's not okay, surely. Sorry, carry on.
Class two, romantic necrophiliacs. Bereaved people who remain attached to their dead lover's body. Class three, necrophiliac fantasizers. So people who fantasize about necrophilia but do not physically interact with corpses. Class four, tactile necrophiliacs. People who are aroused by touching or stroking a corpse without engaging in intercourse.
Oh.
Class five, fetishistic.
I think you got it right first time.
Yeah, I think I've ruined it. Fetish dick. Necrophiliacs. Necrophiliacs. People who remove objects or body parts from a corpse for sexual fetishes. Why am I really struggling with that word? I don't know. Without engaging in intercourse. Class six, necromutilomaniacs. Oh. People who derive pleasure from mutilating a corpse while masturbating without engaging in intercourse. Class seven, opportunistic necrophiliacs. People who normally have no interest in necrophilia but take the opportunity when it arises.
All of these are grossing me out, I'm not going to lie.
Like, oh, I'm just happen to be walking past a morgue.
I'm really spontaneous. If I see a corpse, I like to shag it. Spur of the moment decision.
Oh, sorry, there's 10 classes. Okay, my apologies, it's 10. Class 8, regular necrophiliacs, so people who preferentially have intercourse with the dead. Class 9, homicidal necrophiliacs, so people who murder someone in order to have sex with the victim, i.e. necro-sadists.
Oh.
Class 10, exclusive necrophiliacs, people who have an exclusive interest in sex with the dead and cannot perform at all for a living partner.
Oh.
Yeah.
All of these are making me feel uncomfortable thinking about.
So, additionally, criminologist Lee Meller's typology of homicidal necrophiliacs consists of 8 categories between A to H, and is based on the combination of 2 behavioral axes: D structure, as in offender mutilates the corpse for sexual reasons; preservative, where the offender does not; and cold, meaning offender used the corpse sexually 2 hours or more after death; and warm, offender uses the corpse sexually less than 2 hours after death. So, category A, cold and destructive. The examples for this is Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah.
Category B, cold and preservative. So you got your Gary Ridgway, Dennis Nilsen, and Carl Fansler.
Yeah. There's a really good drama about Dennis Nilsen where David Tennant plays him.
I need to watch that.
Actually. I need to watch that. It came out last year.
Is it on? What's it on?
I want to say it was a BBC thing. Okay. I think it was just called Des. So.
Okay. Okie dokie. Category C is warm and destructive. So the examples are Andre Chikatilo and Joseph Batcher. Category D, warm and preservative. So Robert Yates, Earl Nelson. And category E, dabblers. Richard Ramirez, Mark Dixie.
Richard Ramirez is the Night Stalker, isn't he?
Yeah. Cool. Have you watched the documentary on him?
Yes.
On Netflix?
Yes, I have. And I've seen American Horror Story 1984.
Yeah.
In that.
Category F, cataphysmic, impulsively and explosively lashing out. Category G, exclusive necromutilophiles, Robert Napper, Peter Sutcliffe. in category H, sexual cannibals and vampires, so like Albert Fish and Peter Curtin.
Cool. Well, not right. Cool, but yeah.
Yeah. So the dabblers have a transitory, opportunistic sexual relations with corpses, but do not prefer them. Cataphysmic necrophiliacs commit post-mortem sex acts only while in a sudden impulsive state. Exclusively necromutilophiles derive pleasure purely from mutilating the corpse, while sexual cannibals and vampires are sexually aroused by eating human body parts. Category A, C, and F offenders may also cannibalize or drink the blood of their victims.
Gross.
Yeah. So humans, like, for research, necrophilia is often assumed to be rare, but no data for its prevalence in the general population exists. Some necrophiliacs only fantasize about the fact without carrying it out. In 1958, Claff and Brown commented that although rarely described, necrophiliac fantasizes may occur more often than is generally supposed.
You wouldn't admit to fantasizing about that, would you?
Not unless you really trusted a person to not spread it around.
So there's no way.
Even then, it's a bit.
Yeah, there's no way of knowing the real statistics on how many people are out there that do that.
Yeah, I think it would only, like, you would only find out, like, if they were murdering people or they got caught in, like, you know, you walked in and it was shagging a dead body. But yeah, I don't think anyone would openly be like, hey, I shagged dead bodies.
No. What's your wildest fantasy? Oh, I think about heading down the morgue to pick up chicks.
Rosman and Resnick reviewed 123 cases of necrophilia. The sample was divided into genuine necrophiliacs who had a persistent attraction to corpses and pseudo-necrophiliacs who acted out of opportunity, sadism, or transient interest. Of the total, 92% were male and 92% were male and 8% were female. 57% of the general necrophiliacs had occupational access to corpses with morgue attendants, hospital orderly, and cemetery employees being the most common jobs.
Yeah, else it's a bit too suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine if you was a teacher or something?
Ooh.
And you're like, how would you even get around, like, trying to...
I don't know. You'd have to have access to a cemetery or a morgue or be a murderer on the down low.
Yeah. The researchers theorized that either of the following situations could be antecedents to necrophilia. So, number one, the necrophiliac develops poor self-esteem, perhaps due in part to a significant loss. A, they are very fearful of rejection by others and they desire a sexual partner who is incapable of rejecting them. And or B, they are fearful of the dead and transform their fear by means of reaction formation into a desire. Or number two, they develop an exciting fantasy of sex with a corpse, sometimes after exposure to a corpse.
Hmm.
So the motives, the most common motive for necrophiliacs is the possession of a partner who is unable to resist or reject them. However, in the past, necrophiliacs have expressed having more than one motive. The authors reported that of their sample of genuine necrophiliacs, 68% were motivated by a desire for a non-resisting and non-rejecting partner. 21% were motivated by a want for a reunion with a lost partner. 15% were motivated by sexual attraction to dead people. 15% were motivated by a desire for comfort or to overcome feelings of isolation. 12% were motivated by a desire to remedy low self-esteem by expressing power over a corpse.
Oh.
So the lesser common motives include unavailability of a living partner, compensation for a fear of women, believe that sex with a living woman was a mortal sin, need to achieve a feeling of total control over a sexual partner, compliance with a command or hallucination, performance of a series of destructive acts, expression of polymorphous, perverse sexual desires, and need to perform limitless sexual activity.
Mm.
IQ data was limited but not abnormally low. About half of the sample had a personality disorder and 11% of true necrophiliacs were psychotic. Rosman and Resnick concluded that their data challenged the conventional view of necrophiliacs as generally psychotic, mentally deficient or unable to obtain a consenting partner. Rosman and Resnick reviewed information from 34 cases of necrophilia describing the individual's motivations for their behaviours. These individuals reported the desire to possess a non-resistant and non-rejecting partner, reunions with a deceased partner, sexual attraction to corpses, overcoming feelings of isolation, seeking self-esteem by expressing power over homicide victim.
So essentially it's gross men who can't find a living partner, or it's almost like they don't want to rape someone because that's too much effort. Someone who's alive, because that's too much effort, because that woman's going to fight back. So they just go for dead people instead, so they can't fight back. And then was one of them something like they think it's a sin to have sex with a living woman?
Yeah, so I think that would be a case of like, because when they did the report, it was in the 80s. So around that time, you know, people were still quite religious. And
yeah,
obviously people, well, kids weren't being brought up as yeah. well as they should be. And obviously, like, boys, they have a more fragile ego.
Yeah.
Without insulting them, but they have a very fragile ego. So hence why they're always at a higher percentage of acting out and committing crimes against women.
Yeah.
Purely because of how they've been brought up.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Fuck, man.
I don't understand. I mean, I don't think I'll ever understand why someone shags a dead body, but
no,
I think it's, you know, it's the exposure, I guess. I guess it's like you trying. I think the one that I like understand more is, you know,
mourning a loved one.
Yeah, I mean, that I can understand as well, because it is like
you missed that person. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to phrase it, but then also, like, if you had a fear of death, so you thought that your way of, like, overcoming that fear was to overpower a corpse.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to phrase that, but yeah, that's what I'm going with.
It's like that that Avenged Sevenfold song.
Oh, no. I watched that when I was, like, 14, and I was like, you know when you don't fully understand something, but yeah. you know that, like, what's going on is a bit weird and a bit wrong. And I was like, bro. And now looking back on it, I'm like, shit.
Yeah.
Like, dude. Anyway, that is all my fun facts for you.
Thanks. I loved them. So, out of that list you did with the letters.
Yeah.
The two guys I've got were both on that list.
Okay.
So
I don't think I know any of them apart from Jeffrey Dahmer, like, and Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Fully in detail. So
I'm gonna start with Earl Nelson. What letter was he?
Earl.
Yeah.
Category D, warm and preservative. So that meant offender used the corpse sexually less than 2 hours after death.
Yeah.
But doesn't mutilate the corpse for sexual reasons.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. So Earl Nelson, when he was born, he was named Earl Leonard Ferrell. He was born in 1897 in San Francisco. His mum was English and his dad was Spanish. But both of his parents died of syphilis before he turned two. So he was sent to live with his maternal grandmother, Jenny Nelson, hence the Nelson.
Yep.
Syphilis is a sexually transmitted disease, isn't it?
Yeah.
Lovely. I mean, it was the 1890s, so... So Earl's grandmother, she was a devout Pentecostal, so she raised him alongside her two youngest children, Willis, who was 10 years older than Earl, and Lillian, who was 8 years older than Earl. So he's brought up essentially as a kid with his aunt and uncle in an incredibly not Catholic, because I think Pentecostal's Protestant, a very Christian household, let's say that, because I don't know me religions very well.
Okay.
So as a child, he exhibited a lot of self-loathing and other morbid behaviours from a young age. He was described as a psychotic prodigy by the San Francisco Examiner. He was expelled from school at age 7 due to his, like, weird behaviour. He would regularly talk to invisible people. He would compulsively quote Bible passages. And he was often caught watching female family members undress. He would head to school in freshly cleaned clothes and return home looking like he'd swapped clothes with a homeless person. So like in rags and really dirty. Around the age of 10, he collided with a streetcar whilst riding his bike. This knocked him unconscious for 6 days. And when he woke up, his behavior became even more erratic and he suffered from frequent headaches and periods of memory loss. So as a teenager, his strongly religious upbringing remained a huge influence on him throughout his teenage years. And he obsessively read the Book of Revelation, which is the last book of the New Testament, or its final book in the Christian Bible. And it's also known as like the Apocalypse of John. So I think the Book of Revelation is like the apocalypse part of the Bible.
Yeah.
It was in his early teenage years that he started visiting brothels and bars in San Francisco's Barbary Coast red light district. It just said everywhere where he caught an SDI. And that was it, like just where he caught an SDI. So he was obviously partaking in things at these brothels to catch an SDI. So he dropped out of school at this point and was working a series of manual jobs, but I don't think he kept them for more than like a few months at a time. He's been described as being really short and stocky, but quite physically fit. He had large hands and great upper body strength, and apparently he could comfortably walk long distances on his hands and pick up chairs with his teeth. So he's like short.
That's weird.
Short but strong.
Ugh.
In 1915, he was sentenced to 2 years in San Quentin State Prison after breaking into a cabin which he had believed was abandoned. He was paroled in September 1916, but then arrested again in March 1917 for petty theft. He spent another 6 months in prison before him being discharged. Then he was arrested again shortly after in LA for burglary charges, which led him to spend another 5 months in prison, and then he escaped. So by my maths, that means he came out of prison in February 8, 1918, but everywhere said he got released from prison in late 1917. So around late 1917, early 1918, he's escaped from prison at this point, but he enlisted in the US. He enlisted in the US military, but deserted it after 6 weeks. And he repeated this pattern a few times using different names and different military branches. So in 1918, he was committed to the Napa State Mental Hospital after behaving oddly and erratically during one of his stints in the Navy. A Navy psychologist noticed that Nelson was living in a constant psychotic state. So he's in his early 20s at this point, kind of dicking about in the armed forces until the Navy are like, hang on, son, you're a bit mental, and committing to Napa State Mental Hospital. So when he got to this hospital, the initial observations made by the psychologists noted that he did not seem violent or homicidal or destructive. He regularly spoke of hallucinations and other paranoid delusions, saying that he had seen faces, heard music, and at times believed people were trying to poison him. Voices often whispered at him to kill himself. He said that if he were kept in jail, he would find something sharp and cut the veins in his wrists. He also experienced headaches, dizzy spells, and he fainted a few times during his sessions with the psychologist. During his time at the institution, he escaped over 3 times, earning the nickname Houdini. I think staff eventually just stopped trying to find him. So after one of his escape attempts, they're like, ah, fuck him. And then his file at the hospital was closed with a note indicating he'd improved. And then he wasn't actually discharged from the Navy until 1919, just because he was absent, obviously, because he was in the hospital. So after he had finished escaping from this mental hospital, he got a job working as a janitor at St. Mary's Hospital using the fake name Evan Lewis Fuller. Here he met Mary Martin, who was a 60-year-old administrative worker. So they dated for a couple of months before marrying in August 1919. So he's in his early 20s and he just married a 60-year-old woman. They lived as husband and wife for 6 months before she separated from him. She said he made her life living hell. He'd go into jealous rages. He was showing increasingly violent behavior, religious delusions, and bizarre sexual demands. And some of the bizarre behaviors of his that she mentioned were long disappearances for their home and weird bathing methods. Like, for example, he would pour glasses of water over his toes. Now, I kind of, when I read this, I was like, why is pouring glasses of water over his toes odd? I don't think that's really that bizarre. He just wants to wash his feet, like.
But like in them, in the olden days, back in that day, they used to do that to like, I mean, like wash their feet if they're like, you know, a labourer and they're like on the feet all the time, or like, you know, bad circulation. So like to warm your feet up, basically.
Yeah.
Because if you warm your feet up, your body temperature changes.
Yeah. Well, in the summer, sometimes if I can't sleep and I'm really hot, I'll run my feet under the cold tap in the bath for a bit to cool myself down. So maybe he was just doing that and he's being attacked for his bathing methods. If you're going to victimise him for something, then that's not the thing you'd pick. Anyway, in May 1921, he pretended to be a plumber in order to enter someone's house, and then he tried to molest their 12-year-old daughter in the basement. He wasn't successful, however, as she screamed and her older brother chased Nelson away. He was later caught, and at a competency hearing, he was deemed dangerous and recommitted to the Napa State Mental Hospital where he'd been before. He escaped again on two occasions before being discharged officially in 1925. So he was in there for 4 years this time. They obviously got better at stopping him from escaping.
Yeah.
In 1926, this is when he starts his killing sprees. I'm not going to go into the individual details of each murder because there's quite a lot and they all have a lot of similarities. So he has been linked to 22 victims between 1926 and 1927. His victims consisted of predominantly middle-aged women. However, there was one male child that he killed too. So yeah, his victims were mostly middle-aged landladies who he would reproach. He would approach under the pretense of renting a room. So he'd like search local newspapers for room adverts and then approach any that had female landladies. They would then show him the room in the boarding house, or if their house was for sale, for example, they'd like give him a tour. He would make them feel at ease with his extensive knowledge of the Bible. And then once they trusted him enough to let them access their homes, he would kill them, almost always by strangulation. He would then often engage in necrophilia with the corpse before hiding it, normally under a bed. Although in a few instances, he did hide bodies in like attics or trunks or in the closet or behind a furnace. So at his peak, he was killing around once every 3 weeks on average. But then he would also often kill in like spurts. So his last victim, Emily, was his fifth victim in 10 days. So he did this to 5 women in 10 days. So yeah, so he did this in California, Oregon, Washington, Iowa, Missouri, all across the East Coast of America, the Midwest, and then he went up to Canada as well. Germania Harpin is one of his victims, and she was strangled to death and raped. And then her son Robert was only 8 months old, and he strangled him too. And so then the youngest, ignoring Robert, the youngest of his victims was a girl called Lola Cohen. She was age 14. He kidnapped her, murdered her, and raped her. Police found her decaying corpse stored underneath his bed in a Winnipeg boarding house where he'd rented a room. And then his oldest victims are Laura Beale, who was 63, from California, San Jose, and Lillian St. Mary, who was also 63 from California, but she's from San Francisco. And they were both strangled to death and then raped after death. But like I said at the beginning, he's got such upper body strength and big hands that that must have just been his
method,
I suppose. So Nelson was the first serial murderer in American history whose crimes were subject to widespread media attention in newspapers, magazines, and on the radio, which was new around this time. He was known in the media as the Gorilla Man or the Gorilla Killer, and also the Dark Strangler. Strangler? Strangler.
Yeah.
His confirmed murder count of over 20 people remained a record high for nearly 50 years, when in 1971, the discovery of Juan Corona's crimes beat it. So the way they captured him descriptions of Nelson were sent out to all US police stations from Canada, and sights of him were reported in Regina, Saskatchewan, which I can never say, and Manitoba, which is North Dakota. On the 16th of June, 1927, constables arrested a man supposedly called Virgil Wilson, who matched the description. They initially believed that they had the wrong guy because this guy remained very calm and cooperative and then kept saying it wasn't him. He was put into the local jail but managed to escape the same evening because, of course, he did. He was then recaptured 12 hours after his initial escape because he made the mistake of trying to catch the same train as members of the police. So he was then taken to Rupert Street Police Station in Winnipeg, where he was photographed, fingerprinted, measured, and prepared for identification lineups. Nearly 4,000 people awaited his arrival to try and get a glimpse of him because they'd heard about him in the media. These photos and the fingerprints were sent to police across the US, which resulted in multiple positive identifications from witnesses. The fingerprints were also confirmed to match those of Earl Nelson taken from his previous arrests. He still maintained that he was not Earl Nelson and he was in fact Virgil Wilson. However, these Earl Nelson's fingerprints obviously matched his, and they matched those left behind at several crime scenes, and his teeth also matched bite marks on the victims' bodies. So it's like, dude, come on. So initially, he admitted to his crimes, telling reporters, "I only do my lady killings on a Saturday night." But then he changed his mind and claimed that he was innocent. And he was saying, "I'm charged with 2 murders, but I'm not the one who done it. All of them are wrong." He refused to confess, despite law enforcement agencies urging him to. At the time of his arrest, he was wanted in 6 US cities. His ex-wife testified against him, claiming that he was absolutely insane. Over 60 individuals from Canada and the US testified, many placing him at the scene of the crime or linking him to property stolen from his victims. Because I think in a few occasions he stole their jewelry and then either gave it or sold it on to other people. Yeah. Throughout his trial, he became obsessed with a Bible passage, which I will now read to you. "My son, give me thine heart and let thine eyes observe my ways. For a whore is a deep ditch and a strange woman a narrow pit. She also lieth in wait as for a prey and increaseth the transgressors among men." Which doesn't sound very nice. Like saying she also lieth in wait as for a prey. Like, I don't know if that's saying that the woman is prey or if she's lying in wait, waiting for some prey. But anyway, it only took the jury 40 minutes of deliberation before sentencing him to death. He continued to proclaim his innocence up until the end, and his lawyer even petitioned for clemency on the grounds that he was insane, but this appeal was denied. And he was executed by hanging at 7:30 a.m. on January the 13th, 1928, at the Vaughan Street Jail in Winnipeg. His final words were, "I forgive those who have wronged me."
Oh.
Bit of a scumbag, really.
Yeah.
I think, like you say, he obviously was sleeping with his victims, like, moments after they died, from the sounds of it. So, warm.
While the body's still relatively warm. And then, because I think, like, you have to think about the body decomposing as well. So, like, after an hour, like, you know, the body starts to blow and turn blue and all this nonsense. And after 2 hours, like, the gases of, like, the body and liquids come out. And so you got to have, like, a strong stomach to be shagging a corpse after 2 hours.
You've got to have a strong stomach to kill someone, I think, especially when you're up close. Strangling them,
like. But I think when it comes to, like, you know, is anyone, like, what makes you capable of being a murderer or, like, murdering someone, I think everyone has that capability. It's just, I think with some people who, like, say, forgot, you know, mental health illnesses, or, you know, haven't been brought up in a nice environment and they've been exposed to things at quite an early age. So they're like, versions of right and wrong are like completely different as to, like, you know, someone who's been raised in a good family environment. With, you know, no abandonment or rejection, like, experiences. So I think everyone has that capability within them. I think it just solely depends on, like, you know, the nature versus nurture kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I'd be able to live with the guilt after having killed someone.
Yeah. I don't.
Like, I joke, if someone makes me angry, I don't joke about killing them, but I always joke that I'm going to set up a hit woman company for to kill all these people that are making my friends' lives hell. I don't think I'd actually be able to do it. I'd feel too guilty.
Yeah, I think, but that's kind of different now, because, like, I don't know. In my head, I've got all these thoughts, and I'm like, how do you even explain this? I, like, I just think it totally depends on, you know, the situation and, like, your upbringing and,
yeah,
like, a lot of environmental factors that get included into, like, whether you're capable of murdering someone or not.
Yeah.
I think initially everyone's got that instinct. However, it is dependent on
nurture,
your variables. Yeah.
Absolutely. So my next person is Carl Tanzler. He was also on your list.
Which one was he?
Was he, like, the second one? Was he B?
Yeah, he was B. So he was called preservative.
Yes.
So after 2 hours, but didn't mutilate.
No, he did not mutilate. Carl Tanzler, also known as Count Carl von Kozel, he was born in 1877 in Dresden, which was part of the German Empire, and he grew up in Imperial Germany. So there's not too much on, like, his childhood. The only thing it really said anywhere was that he claims to have been visited by visions of one of his dead ancestors whilst he was growing up. Her name was Countess Anna Constantia von Kozel, and she would reveal to him the face of his true love, who was pictured as, he described as, an exotic dark-haired woman. So he's grown up being visited by his ancestor, who keeps showing him this face of a beautiful woman who is supposed to be his true love. That bit's important.
Okay.
So, again, like, he seems to have gone all over the place a bit, and there's not too much detail. So he spent some time in Australia, where he became interested in engineering and electrical work. He had just begun to build a trans-ocean flyer when World War I broke out. So this is 1914. And he was put into a concentration camp for, in quotation marks, safekeeping. Obviously, he's German. World War I, if Germans were the bad guys, I suppose. So he's put in essentially a concentration camp in Australia. Later, he was moved to Trial Bay, which was a castle-like prison on top of a cliff, still in Australia. After the war, the prisoners were not allowed to return to their former homes. Instead, they were shipped to Holland, where he was then released and returned to Germany. So he's travelled around a bit, become an engineer, been a prisoner of war, and then gone home. In 1920, so this is after the war, obviously, it was around then that he married a woman called Doris Schaefer. They had two daughters together, Aisha and Clarista. In 1926, he sailed from Rotterdam to the USA, which is a long fucking way. Yep. He then settled in Florida, where his sister was already living, and his wife and kids joined him at a later date. So at this point, he was settled in a place called Zephyr Hills. But in 1927, he moved to Key West, leaving his wife and kids behind in Zephyr Hills, which is approximately a 7.5-hour drive away. Which, I know, the UK is so small compared to America, but it blows my mind that you could drive for 7.5 hours and still be in the same state, whereas that would actually take us to a different country from here.
Yeah, I think we'll be in where would we be? In France?
We could go to Scotland, easy. We could go to France. I think depending on ferry crossings and stuff, you could probably even go to, like, what's right of France? Holland. You could probably drive to Holland in 7 hours.
Yeah. And then you've got I'm trying to picture the map in my head.
Yeah.
You got France, and then you can go downwards, like hit a bit of Spain, and then Portugal.
Yeah.
And then you can go up to like Netherlands.
Yeah. So in Key West, he's on his own. He's left his wife and kids behind. He started working as a radiology technician at the Marine Hospital. He used the name Carl von Kozel at this point. So his real name's Carl Tanzler, but he's using the name Carl von Kozel. So in 1930, whilst working at this hospital, he met a woman called Maria Elena Milagro de Hoyos. She was a Cuban-American woman who was viewed as a local beauty, and she had been brought to the hospital by her mother for a checkup. So Tanzler immediately recognized her as the beautiful dark-haired woman that had been revealed to him in his visions when he was a child, and he became absolutely obsessed with her. He was, she was actually married but estranged from her husband, and he was 32 years older than her. So she was eventually diagnosed with tuberculosis, which was a fatal disease at the time because they didn't have the vaccination for it. Also, anytime anyone mentions tuberculosis, I just think of Moulin Rouge, where she's coughing and there's blood. That's a clear sign in those kinds of films that someone's going to die. So she's been diagnosed with tuberculosis. Tanzler does not even remotely have the right medical training to treat her, but he insists on treating her because obviously he's obsessed with her. So he attempted to treat her with a variety of specially made tonics and potions and medicines and multiple pieces of electrical equipment, including x-rays. I'm not sure how you're going to heal tuberculosis with an x-ray, but I suppose he didn't know that. He did all of this from the comfort of Elena's home, whilst showering her with gifts of jewellery and clothing and declaring his undying love for her. Despite his best untrained efforts, she died of tuberculosis at her parents' home in October of 1931. Bear in mind, he's got a wife and kids and he's doing all this. He paid for her funeral and got permission from her family to build an above-ground mausoleum in the Key West Cemetery for her. He visited her here almost every night for 2 years. And I think he lost his job around this time. So every night he's visiting her grave and singing to her and all sorts. But then in April of 1933, he abducted her body from the mausoleum. He carted her body through the cemetery on a toy wagon under cover of darkness and took her home. His excuse for this was that she would often appear to him whilst he sat beside her grave serenading her, and this apparition would regularly tell him to take her from her grave and to take him home. So he genuinely thinks the ghost of this girl has told him to steal her corpse. Once home, Tanzler attached the corpse's bones together with pieces of piano wire and coat hangers. He fitted the face with glass eyes. As her skin decomposed, he would replace it with silk cloth soaked in wax and plaster of Paris. As her hair fell out of her decomposing scalp, he collected it and made it into a wig for her, along with more of her hair that he'd already got from her mother. He filled the corpse's abdominal and chest cavities with rags to like keep her shape and prevent her from looking sunken. He dressed her in stockings, jewellery and gloves and kept her in his bed. He kept her in his bed. He also had to use large amounts of perfume, disinfectants and preserving agents to mask the smell and to try and delay the decomposition. The entire town became suspicious of him, because obviously it's this reclusive man who doesn't go out, doesn't leave his house much, doesn't have a job, and he's regularly buying women's clothes and perfume. A young boy also claims to see him dancing in the wind through the window with a giant doll. So in October 1940, bear in mind he stole her body in 1933, so this is 7.5 years later.
Oh my god.
Elena's sister heard these rumors And she kind of put two and two together and thought, is this my sister that he's got? And she went over to his home and confronted him, where she saw the body. Or I think she saw the doll and she wasn't sure if it was a body or not, but she contacted the authorities. They turned up and they were like, yes, this is a human. This is human remains. He was quickly arrested and after a psychiatric examination was found to be completely mentally competent. Competent enough to stand trial on the charge of wantonly and maliciously destroying a grave and removing a body without authorization. However, the case was dropped and he was released as the statute of limitations for the crime had expired. So because his grave robbing was 7.5 years prior, they dropped all charges because that was too long after to charge him for it.
Bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. So her body was then examined by physicians and pathologists before being put on public display in a funeral home where it was viewed by over 6,800 people. She was eventually returned to the cemetery where she had initially been buried, but she was provided with a new secret unmarked grave to prevent further tampering because, of course, he's still alive and he's out and about. Yeah. So some research in the 1970s has since uncovered evidence of necrophilia. Two physicians present at the 1940 autopsy recalled that a tube had been inserted into the vaginal area of the corpse that allowed for intercourse. Essentially, he built her like a usable vagina, I suppose. However, none of this was actually documented at the time in 1940, and they've got no photos of those areas and stuff. So this allegation is questionable. I think a lot of this was publicised in the media, but the public mood was generally sympathetic towards him. They just saw him as an eccentric romantic. Oh, people are fucked up, man.
People annoy me, man.
Yeah. So after all of this, he moved back closer to his wife. Apparently, she helped support him in his later years, like as he got older. And he was granted US citizenship in 1950. He used a death mask to create a life-sized effigy of Elena, and he lived with it until he died at age 75. His body was discovered 3 weeks after his death on the floor of his home. Some rumors suggest that he was in the arms of the like effigy that he'd built of her. There's also rumors and theories that he had actually found a way to switch the effigy for her actual body and that the doll that he died with was actually her real remains. But I feel like you'd be able to tell, would you not? Would you go back and test it? Would you go to the graves and see if that was actually her in there? Don't know. Anyway, some reports state that his ultimate goal was to fly her high into the stratosphere so that radiation from outer space could penetrate her tissues and restore some life to her. So even though he was like psychologically competent, I think there was still something not quite right there.
Yeah, I mean, the media doesn't fucking help at all. Like, you're just as bad as him, like, displaying her, like, for people to see. And
yeah. Oh, yeah.
That business. Like, you're literally, like, trying to persecute someone for doing that. And then you're like, hey, why don't we just put her on display so everyone can come in and all of a sudden we're making loads of money from like tourists. Ooh.
It was a show. She was put on display in a funeral home, like not a museum or anything. But would you not keep it private so the family could pay their respects? Letting almost 7,000 people in there to see her corpse, I think, is really disrespectful.
It's insensitive.
Though maybe in some cultures, I have a feeling in some cultures it's not deemed disrespectful. And it's actually quite a nice thing to do. But still.
Yeah, but at that point, her body are like,
I don't think it, on the photos, it didn't really look like her anymore. So he had her for 7.5 years. She had been dead for 9.5 years at this point, and he was still sleeping next to this corpse. Or with.
Oh, no. I can't even stand, like, sleeping through, like, when my cat shit.
Yeah, no.
Like, trying to sleep next to a decomposing body. I don't fucking think so.
Nope.
Oh, get rid of that body. Let the body rest.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say let the bodies hit the floor then from that. Is it a Powerful song?
Let the bodies hit the floor. The bodies hit the floor. Ooh.
Yeah. So that is a tale of, I think some people call it the tale of the corpse bride, but I think that's horrific.
Poor yeah, we're not gonna ruin a Tim Burton film here.
No.
Jesus.
Not that.
I just
anyway. Yeah.
I don't know how people. Ugh.
So yeah, he's a really good example of category B, which I can't remember exactly what it was, but cold preservative, because obviously she's very dead, but he's trying to preserve her how she was, I suppose.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
I don't understand it, but no judgment here.
Oh,
all safe judgment. Space. right, are you ready for Big Jeff?
Oh, I think so.
You sure?
Yeah. Yeah, go, okay. Go, go.
Okay, so Big Jeff, also known as Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer, also known as the Milwaukee Cannibal or the Milwaukee Monster, was an American serial killer and sex offender who committed the murder and dismemberment of 17 men and boys between 1978 and 1991. Many of his later murders involved necrophilia, cannibalism, and the permanent preservation of body parts, typically all or part of the skeleton. Although he was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, and a psychotic disorder, Dahmer was found to be legally sane at his trial. He was convicted of 15 of the 16 murders he had committed in Wisconsin and was sentenced to 15 terms of life imprisonment on February 17, 1992. Dahmer was later sentenced to a 16th term of life imprisonment for an additional homicide committed in Ohio in 1978. On November the 28th, 1994, Dahmer was beaten to death by Christopher Scarver. I can't read his last name. A fellow inmate at the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin. Dahmer was born May 21st, 1960 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the first of two sons of Joyce, a teletype machine instructor, and Lionel Herbert Dahmer, a Marquette University chemistry student. Some sources report Dahmer was deprived of attention as an infant. Other sources, however, suggest that Dahmer was generally doted upon as an infant and toddler by both parents. Although his mother was known to be tense, greed for both attention and pity, and argumentative with her husband and neighbours. As Dahmer entered first grade, Lionel's university studies kept him away from home much of the time. When he was home, his wife, a hypochondriac who suffered from depression, demanded constant attention and spent an increasing amount of time in bed. On one occasion, she is known to have attempted suicide with Equinol. Consequently, neither parent devoted much time to their son, who later recollected that from an early age, he felt unsure of the solidity of the family, recalling extreme tension and numerous arguments between his parents during his early years. Dahmer had been an energetic and happy child, but became notably subdued after a double hernia surgery shortly before his fourth birthday. At elementary school, Dahmer was regarded as quiet and timid. One teacher had detected early signs of abandonment in Dahmer due to his mother's illnesses. The symptoms which increased when she was pregnant again with her second child. Nonetheless, in grade school, Dahmer did have a small number of friends. I'm brave. From an early age, Dahmer manifested an interest in dead animals. He initially collected large insects, such as dragonflies and butterflies, and put them in jars. Later, he collected animal carcasses, occasionally accompanied by one or more friends. He dismembered these animals either at home or in a nearby woodland. According to one friend, Dahmer dismembered these animals and stored the parts in jars in the family's tool shed, explaining that he was curious as to how animals fitted together.
Ooh. That's a really creepy thing for a kid to say.
Just read a fucking book. That's all I'm going to say. Read a fucking book.
The book will tell you how to put together if you really want to know.
Yeah. His fascination with dead animals may have begun at the age of four. he saw his father removing animal bones from beneath the family home. According to his father, Dharma was oddly thrilled by the sound of bones, by the sound bones made, and became preoccupied with animal bones. He occasionally searched beneath and around the house for more bones and explored the bodies of live animals to discover where the bones were located. In one instance, Dharma decapitated the carcass of a dog before nailing the body to a tree and impaling a skull on a stake beside a wooden cross in the woodland behind his house.
Like the grossest of children.
I know. I'd be like, what the fuck are you doing there, Jeff?
Yeah, come on, Jeff.
Like, come on. During a chicken dinner, Dharma asked Lionel that what would happen if the chicken bones were placed in bleach. Lionel, pleased by what he believed to be his son's scientific curiosity, demonstrated how to safely bleach and preserve animal bones. Dharma incorporated these preserving techniques into his bone collection.
Oh.
I'm like, Lionel, you stupid bastard.
I don't know. Science is cool, but it can quickly go from harmless curiosity to mass murderer.
Just like, I don't know, just ask the intention behind it. Like, why do you want to know?
Yeah.
From his freshman year at Revere High School, Dharma was seen as an outcast. By the age of 14, he had begun drinking beer and hard alcohol in daylight hours, frequently concealing his liquor inside the lining of the army fatigue jacket he wore to school. He is known to have mentioned to one classmate who inquired why he was drinking scotch in the morning history class that the alcohol he consumed was his medicine. Although largely uncommunicative in his freshman year, Dharma was seen by staff as polite and highly intelligent, but with average grades. He was a keen tennis player and played briefly in the high school band. When he reached puberty, Dharma discovered he was gay. He did not tell his parents. In his early teens, he had a brief relationship with another teenage boy, although they never had intercourse. By Dharma's later admission, he began fantasizing about dominating and controlling a completely submissive male partner in his early to mid-teens, and his masturbatory fantasies gradually evolved to his focusing upon the chests and torsos of the focus of his fantasies. These fantasies gradually became intertwined with dissection, as you do.
Yeah, obviously. Like,
why the fuck not? When he was about 16, Dharma conceived a fantasy of rendering unconscious a particular male jogger he found attractive and then making sexual use of his body. On one occasion, Dharma concealed himself in bushes with a baseball bat to lay in wait for this man. However, he did not pass by on that particular day. Dharma later said that was his first attempt to attack someone. Despite being regarded as a loner and an oddball among his peers, at school, Dharma became something of a class clown who often staged pranks, which became known as doing a Dharma. These included bleating and simulating epileptic seizures or cerebral palsy at school and local stores. By 1977, Dharma's grades had declined. His parents hired a private tutor with limited success. The same year, in an attempt to save the marriage, his parents attended counselling sessions. They continued to quarrel frequently. When Lionel discovered Joyce had engaged in a brief affair in September 1977, they both decided to divorce, telling their sons they wished to do so amicably. Lionel moved out of the house in early 1978, temporarily residing in a motel on North Cleveland, Massillon Road. In May 1978, Dharma graduated from high school. A few weeks before his graduation, one of his teachers observed Dharma sitting close to the school parking lot, drinking several cans of beer. When the teacher threatened to report the matter, Dharma informed him he was experiencing a lot of problems at home and that the school's guidance counsellor was aware of them. That spring, Joyce and David moved out of the family home to live with relatives in Wisconsin. Dharma had just turned 18 and remained in the family home. Dharma's parents' divorce was finalised on July 24th. And Joyce was awarded custody of a younger son and alimony payments. So no one gave a shit about Jeff at this point.
And then he's 18, so I think in a court of law, it doesn't, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, he's not like, he's not a dependent, is he?
No,
he's 18.
That's the word.
But I don't think this showed initial interest to try and make sure that, you know, he was looked after, basically.
Yeah.
They just kind of backed him off. Dharma committed his first murder in 1978, 3 weeks after his graduation. At the time, he was living alone in his family home in Bath. On June 18th, Dahmer picked up a hitchhiker named Stephen Mark Hicks, who was almost 19. Dahmer lured the youth to his house on the pretext of drinking. Hicks, who had been hitchhiking to a rock concert in Ohio, agreed to accompany Dahmer to his house upon the promise of a few beers with Dahmer, as he had the house to himself.
Yeah.
According to Dahmer, the sight of the bare-chested Hicks standing at the roadside stirred his sexual feelings, although when Hicks began talking about girls, he knew any sexual passes he made would be rebuffed. After several hours of talking, drinking and listening to music, Hicks wanted to leave, and he didn't want him to. Dahmer bludgeoned Hicks with a 10-pound dumbbell. He later stated he struck Hicks twice from behind with a dumbbell as Hicks sat upon a chair. When Hicks fell unconscious, Dahmer strangled him to death with the bar of the dumbbell, and then stripped the clothes from Hicks's body before exploring his chest with his hands and then masturbating as he stood above the corpse.
Aww.
The following day, Dahmer dissected Hicks's body in his basement. He later buried the remains in a shallow grave in his backyard before several weeks later unearthing the remains and paring the flesh from the bones. Oh. He dissolved the flesh in acid before flushing the solution down the toilet. That's fucking gross.
Yeah.
He crushed the bones with a sledgehammer and scattered them in the woodland behind the family home.
Oh.
Yeah. So 6 weeks after the murder of Hicks, Dahmer's father and his fiancée returned to his home where they discovered Jeffrey living alone at the house. That August, Dahmer enrolled at Ohio State University, hoping to major in business. Dahmer's sole term at uni was completely unproductive, largely because of his persistent alcohol abuse throughout the majority of the term. He received falling grades in Introduction to Anthropology, Classical Civilizations, and Administrative Science. The only course Dahmer was successful at was riflery, having received a B grade. His overall GPA was 0.45 over 4.0.
The fuck? Riflery?
Yeah. I mean, are you really surprised?
No, America? I'm not. But what did you say, uni? Guns. Like, how can you get... You can't get more American than that.
On one occasion, Lionel paid a surprise visit to his son, only to find his room strewn with empty liquor bottles. Despite his father having paid in advance for the second term, Dahmer dropped out of the uni after just 3 months. Mm. And then his dad convinced him to go to the army, where he was described as an average or slightly above average soldier. Eventually, his alcohol abuse was found out and his performance deteriorated. He was deemed unsuitable for military service and was later discharged from the army. He received an honourable discharge as his superiors did not believe that any problems Dahmer had in the army would be applicable to civilian life. Like, okay, sure, why not? Eventually, he returned to Ohio. He initially resided with his father and stepmother, insisted on being delegated numerous chores to occupy his time while he looked for work. He continued to drink heavily, and 2 weeks after his return, he was arrested for drunken disorderly conduct, for which he was fined $60 and given a suspended 10-day jail sentence. His father tried unsuccessfully to wean his son off alcohol. In December 1981, he and his stepmother sent him to live with his grandmother in West Allis, Wisconsin. Dahmer's grandmother was the only family member to whom he displayed any affection. Oh. They hoped that her influence, plus the change of scenery, might persuade Dahmer to quit drinking, finding a job, and live responsibly. By late 1985, Dahmer had begun to regularly frequent the bathhouses, which he later described as being relaxing places. But during his sexual encounters, became frustrated at his partner's moving during the sexual act. Following his arrest, he stated, "I trained myself to view people's objects of pleasure instead of people." For this reason, beginning in June 1986, he administered sleeping pills to his partners, giving them liquor laced with the sedatives.
Mm.
He then waited for his partners to fall asleep before performing various sexual acts. To maintain an adequate supply of this medication, Dahmer informed doctors he worked nights and required the tablets to adjust his body to work on sociable hours. After approximately 12 such instances, the bathhouse's administration revoked Dahmer's membership and he began to use hotel rooms to continue this practice. Shortly after his membership of the bathhouses was revoked, Dahmer read a report in the newspaper regarding the upcoming funeral of an 18-year-old male. He conceived the idea of stealing the freshly interred corpse and taking it home. Oh. According to Dharma, he attempted to dig up the coffin from the ground but found the soil too hard and abandoned the plan. Like, I mean, if you're going to be devoted about, you know, if you're going to want to do it, at least be devoted about it.
I mean, good on him for trying to get rid of his murderous urges, I suppose.
Yeah, but then it just came back up anyway, didn't it?
Yeah.
On September the 8th, 1986, Dharma was arrested upon a charge of lewd and lascivious behaviour. That's a big word.
Mm.
For masturbating in the presence of two 12-year-old boys as he stood close to the Kinnick River. He initially claimed he had merely been urinating, unaware that there were witnesses, but soon admitted the offence. The charge was changed to disorderly conduct. And on March the 10th, 1987, Dharma was sentenced to 1 year probation with additional instructions he was to undergo counselling.
So, like, he's, like, in and out of prison for the odd little indecent exposure type gross things, and they're trying to send him to counselling to fix him, but it obviously does not work.
Yeah. So, on November the 20th, 1987, Dharma, at the time residing with his grandmother, encountered a 25-year-old man from Ontonagon, Michigan, Stephen Turomi, at a bar and persuaded him to return to the Ambassador Hotel in Milwaukee, where Dharma had rented a room for the evening. According to Dharma, he had no intention of murdering Turomi, but rather intended to simply drug him and lie beside him as he explored his body. The following morning, however, Dharma awoke to find Turomi lying beneath him on the bed, his chest crushed in and black and blue with bruises. Blood was also seeping from the corner of his mouth, and Dharma's fist and one forearm were extensively bruised. Dharma stated he had no memory of having killed Turomi and later informs investigators that he could not believe this had happened.
Sure.
Like, whatever you say, Jeff. Whatever you say.
I believe you.
To dispose of Turomi's body, Dharma purchased a large suitcase in which he transported the body to his grandmother's residence. There, 1 week later, he severed their head, arms and legs from the torso. Ugh.
You gotta have a look for that.
I know, yeah. Then filleted. Are you coughing or are you gagging then?
I started coughing and then you said the word filleted and it turned into a gag.
And then filleted the bones from the body before cutting the flesh into pieces small enough to handle. Dharma then placed the flesh inside plastic garbage bags. He wrapped the bones inside a sheet and pounded them into splinters with a sledgehammer. He fucking loves that shit. The entire dismemberment process took Dharma approximately 2 hours to complete, and he disposed all of Turomi's remains, excluding the severed head, in the trash.
Just put it in the bin?
Yeah. apart from the head.
Okay.
He kept the head.
Obviously.
Because who wouldn't want to keep a head? For a total 2 weeks following Turomi's murder, Dharma retained the victim's head wrapped in a blanket. After 2 weeks, Dharma boiled the head in a mixture of Soilex, an alkali-based industrial detergent, and bleached in an effort to retain the skull, which he then reused as a stimulus for masturbation.
Oh, God.
Eventually, the skull was rendered too brittle by this bleaching process, so Dharma pulverized and disposed of it. Oh.
Disgusting.
Following the murder of Turomi, Dharma began to actively seek victims, most of whom he encountered in or close to gay bars and whom he typically lured to his grandmother's home. He would drug his victim with triazolam or temazepam before shortly after engaging in sexual activity with them. Once he had rendered his victim unconscious with sleeping pills, he killed them by strangulation.
Oh.
2 months after the first killing, Dharma encountered a 14-year-old Native American male prostitute named James Docs Tater. I'll say that correctly. Jesus.
Wait, 14-year-old male prostitute?
Yeah.
That's really sad.
Dharma lured... Why did he keep saying lured? Dharma lured the youth to his home with an offer of $50 to pose for nude pictures. At Dharma's West Alice residence, the pair engaged in sexual activity before he drugged the prostitute and strangled him on the floor of the cellar. Dharma left the body in the cellar for 1 week before dismembering it in much the same manner as he had with Turomi. He placed all of the victim's remains, excluding the skull, in the trash. The skull was boiled and cleansed in bleach before Dominoed it had been rendered too brittle by this process, and he pulverized the skull 2 weeks later. On March 24th, 1988, Dharma met a 22-year-old bisexual man named Richard. I'm not even going to say his last name. It's not happening. I just can't pronounce that.
Sorry, Richard.
Sorry, Richard. Outside a gay bar called The Phoenix. Dharma lured him to his grandmother's residence, although the incentive on this occasion was $50 to simply spend the remainder of the night with him. He then drugged him with sleeping pills and strangled him with a leather strap with Dharma, and then performing oral sex upon the corpse. Dharma dismembered his body within 24 hours of murdering him, again disposing of the remains in the trash and retaining the skull before pulverizing it several months later. He lured another young man to his house. However, after giving the victim a drug coffee, both he and the intended victim had his grandmother called, "Is that you, Jeff?" Although Dharma replied in a manner that led his grandmother to believe he was alone, she did observe that Dharma was not. Because of this, Dharma opted not to kill his particular victim, instead waiting until he had become unconscious before taking him to County General Hospital. Good on you, Grandma.
Yeah, she saved a life that day.
Yeah. Unknowingly as well. Can you imagine?
That poor grandma.
I know, bless her. In September 1988, Dharma's grandmother asked him to move out, largely because of his drinking, his habit of bringing your men to a house late at night, and foul smells occasionally emanating from both the basement and the garage.
Of course. Oh, does she not even go and check?
I don't. At that point, I'm kind of glad that she didn't, because can you imagine that was you in that situation? You're like, what's that smell? And then you went to go look and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Oh. So he found a one-bedroom apartment on North 24th Street and moved into his new residence on September the 25th. The following day, he was arrested for drugging and sexually fondling a 13-year-old boy whom he had lured to his home on the pretext of posing nude for photographs. Dharma's father hired an attorney named Gerald Boyle to defend his son. At Boyle's request, Dharma underwent a series of psychological evaluations prior to his upcoming court hearings. These evaluations revealed Dharma harbored deep feelings of alienation. A second evaluation 2 months later revealed Dharma to be an impulsive individual, suspicious of others, and dismayed by his lack of accomplishments in life. His probation officer would also reference the 1987 diagnosis of Dharma suffering from a schizoid personality disorder for presentation to the court. He was convicted in January 1989 of second-degree sexual assault and then of enticing a child for immoral purposes. Sentencing for the assault was suspended until May 1989. On March 20th, Dharma commenced a 10-day Easter absence from work, during which he moved back into his grandmother's home. 2 months after his conviction and 2 months prior to his sentencing for the sexual assault, Dharma murdered his fifth victim, a mixed-race 24-year-old aspiring model named Anthony Sears, whom Dharma met at a gay bar. According to Dharma, on this particular occasion, he was not looking to commit a crime. However, shortly before closing time that evening, Sears just started talking to me. Dharma lured Sears to his grandmother's home, where the pair engaged in oral sex before Dharma drugged and strangled Sears. The following morning, he placed the corpse in his grandmother's bathtub, where he decapitated the body before attempting to flay the corpse.
Oh.
Come on, Jeff. He then stripped the flesh from the body and pulverized the bones, which he again disposed of in the trash. According to Dharma, he found Sears exceptionally attractive, and Sears was the first victim from whom he permanently retained any body parts. He preserved his head and genitalia in acetone and stored them in a wooden box, which he later placed in his work locker. When he moved to a new address the following year, he took the remains there.
Oh. It kept it in his work locker.
Yeah. What are you doing over there, Jeff?
Just looking up.
Nothing to see. Nothing to see in here. On May 23rd, 1989, Dharma was sentenced to 5 years probation and 1 year in the House of Correction with work release permitted in order that he be able to keep his job. He was also required to register as a sex offender.
Oh.
Yeah. So on May 14th, 1990, Dharma moved out of his grandmother's house, moved into an apartment, taking his mummified head and genitals with him.
Of course.
Within 1 week of his moving into his new apartment, Dharma had killed his sixth victim, Raymond Smith. Smith was a 32-year-old male prostitute whom Dharma lured to his apartment with the promise of $50 for sex. Inside the apartment, he gave Smith a drink laced with 7 sleeping pills and then manually strangled him. The following day, Dharma purchased a Polaroid camera with which he took several pictures of Smith's body in suggestive positions. Before dismembering him in the bathroom, he boiled the legs, arms and pelvis in a steel kettle with Soilex, which allowed him to then rinse the bones in his sink. Dharma dissolved the remainder of Smith's skeleton, excluding the skull, in a container filled with acid. He later spray painted Smith's skull, which he placed alongside the skull of Sears upon a black towel inside a metal filing cabinet.
Oh.
You know, because we've got to have our own collections, you know?
Yep. He's like the collector of Marvel.
Yeah. Approximately 1 week after the murder of Smith, Dharma lured another young man to his apartment. On this occasion, he accidentally consumed the drink laden with sedatives himself, intended for consumption by his guest.
Oh, no.
When he awoke the following day, he discovered his intended victim had stolen several items of his clothing, $300 and a watch. He never reported the incident to the police.
Obviously.
Although on May 29th, he divulged to his probation officer that he had been robbed. On June 1990, he lured a 27-year-old acquaintance named Edward Smith to his apartment. He drugged and strangled him. On this occasion, Revenin immediately acidifying the skeleton or repeating previous processes of bleaching. Dharma placed Smith's skeleton in his freezer for several months in the hope it would not retain moisture. Freezing the skeleton does not remove moisture, and the skeleton of the victim would be acidified several months later.
Ugh.
Dharma accidentally destroyed the skull when he placed it in the oven to dry, a process that caused the skull to explode.
Oh.
Dharma himself was to later. I know, yeah. Dharma himself was to later inform police he had felt rotten about Smith's murder as he had been unable to retain any parts of his body. So essentially, it's just the same thing. Like, he keeps,
yeah,
he keeps doing the same thing, where it's like, you know, trying to get these male prostitutes or male acquaintances that he meets in this gay bar, strangles them after he drugs them, and obviously does what he wants with the bodies, take pictures, you know.
Yeah.
Does and he, keep them in his bank.
Does he always go to the same bar?
It mentions like one bar and then doesn't really mention anything else, but I'm assuming he does. I think he just goes to the same like area,
yeah,
where he knows he can pick up men that are actually interested in other men.
Yeah.
In April 1991, Dharma encountered a 19-year-old named Errol Lindsay walking to get a key cut. Lindsay was heterosexual. Dharma lured him to his apartment where he drugged him, drilled a hole in his skull, and poured hydrochloric acid into it.
Oh.
According to Dharma, Lindsay awoke after this experiment, saying, "I have a headache. What time is it?"
Whoa.
I know, yeah. In response to this, Dharma again drugged Lindsay and strangled him. He decapitated Lindsay and retained his skull. He then flayed Lindsay's body, placing skin in a solution of cold water and salt for several weeks in the hope of permanently retaining it. Reluctantly, he disposed of Lindsay's skin when he noted it had become too frayed and brittle.
Oh, gosh, this is horrific.
By 1991, fellow residents of the Oxford apartments had repeatedly complained to the building's manager of the foul smells emanating from apartment 213, in addition to the sounds of falling objects and the occasional sound of a chainsaw.
Oh, he's not discreet, is he?
You're like, what the fuck?
No one here has a garden. What's going on?
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, Jeffrey.
Prince Will did contact Dharma in response to these complaints on several occasions, although he initially excused the odours emanating from his apartment as being caused by his freezer breaking, causing the contents to become spoiled. On later occasions, he informed Prince Will that the reason for the resurgence of the odour was that several tropical fish had recently died and that he would take care of the matter.
Just my fish. Don't worry, dude. The chainsaw, no. The men yelling, the smell, just my dead fish.
On the afternoon of May 26, Dharma encountered a 14-year-old teenager named Conorak on Wisconsin Avenue. Jesus, I must speak. Unknown to Dharma, Conorak was a younger boy, a younger brother of the boy whom he had molested in
1988. No.
He approached the youth with an offer of money to accompany him to the to his apartment to pose for Polaroid pictures. According to Dharma, Conorak was initially reluctant to the proposal before changing his mind and accompanying him to the apartment, but the youth posed for two pictures in his underwear before Dharma drugged him into unconsciousness and performed oral sex on him.
Oh.
Yeah. On this occasion, Dharma drilled a single hole into his skull through which he injected hydrochloric acid into the frontal lobe. Before he fell unconscious, Dharma led the boy into his bedroom with the body of 31-year-old Tony Hughes, whom Dharma killed 3 days earlier naked on the floor. According to Dharma, he believed that Conorak saw this body, yet did not react to seeing the bloated corpse. Likely because of the effects of the sleeping pills he had ingested and the hydrochloric acid Dharma had injected through his skull. Conorak soon became unconscious, whereupon Dharma drank several beers while lying alongside him before leaving his apartment to drink at a bar and purchase more alcohol. In the early morning hours of May 27th, Dharma returned toward his apartment to discover Conorak sitting naked on the corner of 25th and State, talking in his native language, with three distressed young women standing near him. Dharma approached the women, and told them that Conorak was his friend and attempting to lead him to his apartment by the arm. The three women dissuaded Dharma, explaining they had phoned 911. Upon the arrival of two Milwaukee police officers, Dharma's demeanor relaxed. He told the officers that Conorak was his 19-year-old boyfriend, that he had drunk too much following a quarrel, and that he frequently behaved in this manner when intoxicated. Dharma added his lover had consumed Jack Daniel's Daniel's whiskey that evening. I was like, how are you getting away with this?
Hello.
The three women were exasperated, and when one of the trio attempted to indicate to one of the officers, both of whom had observed no injuries beyond a scrape on Conorak's knee and believe him to be intoxicated, that Conorak had blood upon his testicles, was bleeding from his rectum, and that he had seemingly struggled against Dharma's attempts to walk him to his apartment prior to their arrival. The officer harshly informed her to butt out, shut the hell up, and to not interfere.
Ooh.
So shortly after the arrival of the Milwaukee police officers, three members of the fire department arrived at the scene. These individuals also explained that Conorak for injuries and provided a yellow blanket for the police officers to cover him before leaving the scene. Shortly thereafter, Officer Richard Parubkan arrived at the scene. He and another officer escorted Dharma and Conorak to Dharma's apartment, as Dharma repeatedly commented on the general crime in the neighborhood and of his appreciation of the police. Inside his apartment, and in an effort to verify his claim that he and Conorak were lovers, Dharma showed his officers the two semi-nude Polaroid pictures he had taken of the youth the previous evening.
Oh.
Though the officer said he smelled nothing unusual, his partner later stated he noted a strange scent reminiscent of excrement inside the apartment. This odour emanated from the decomposing body of Hughes. Dharma stated that to investigate this odour, one officer simply peeked his head around the bedroom but really didn't take a good look. The officers then left with a departing remark that Dharma take good care of Conorak. This incident was listed by the officers as a domestic dispute.
No. Oh.
Yeah, it's still going. No. This is the last bit anyway. Upon the departure of the three officers from his apartment, Dharma again injected hydrochloric acid into Conorak's brain. On this second occasion, the injection proved fatal. The following day, May 28th, Dharma took a day's leave from work to devote himself to the dismemberment of the bodies of Conorak and Hughes. He retained both victims' skulls. On June 30th, Dharma travelled to Chicago, where he encountered a 20-year-old named Matt Turner at a bus station. Turner accepted Dharma's offer to travel to Milwaukee for a professional photo shoot. The apartment, Dharma drugged, strangled and dismembered Turner and placed his head and internal organs in a plastic bag in the freezer. Turner was not reported missing. 5 days later, on July 5th, Dharma lured 23-year-old Jeremiah Weinberger from a Chicago bar to his apartment on the promise of spending the weekend with him. He drugged him and tried to inject a boiling water through his skull, sending him into a coma from which he died 2 days later.
Oh.
On July 15th, He encountered the 24-year-old Oliver Lacey at the corner of 27th and Kilburn. Lacey agreed to Dahmer's ruse of posing for nude photographs and accompanied him to his apartment, where the pair engaged in tentative sexual activity before Dahmer drugged Lacey. On this occasion, Dahmer intended to prolong the time he spent with Lacey while alive. After unsuccessfully attempting to render Lacey unconscious with chloroform, he phoned his workplace to request a day's absence. This was granted, although the next day he was suspended. After strangling Lacey, Dahmer had sex with the corpse before dismembering him. He placed Lacey's head and heart in the refrigerator and his skeleton in the freezer. 4 days later, on July 19th, Dahmer received word that he was fired. Upon receipt of this news, Dahmer lured 25-year-old Joseph Braidhoff to his apartment. He was strangled and left lying on Dahmer's bed, covered with a sheet for 2 days. On July the 21st, Dahmer removed these sheets to find the head covered in maggots, whereupon he decapitated the body, cleaned the head, and placed it in the refrigerator. He later acidified his torso, along with those of two other victims killed within the previous month.
Oh, Christ.
And eventually he was caught, and this just goes on about his arrest. But yeah, I feel like I'm going to have to leave it there. I feel like that was enough gruesome information for everyone to know. But apparently he kept approaching like young men and boys doing the same process of, I think it was quite evident that he was trying to experiment and hopefully trying to immobilize these men, but while still keeping them alive, so they were just there for his purpose, essentially being like deck slaves.
So he's kind of almost wanting to create zombies.
Yeah, kind in a way. Like sex zombies.
Hmm.
But he kept approaching like people, and I think eventually he got caught. And obviously he was keeping remains in his fridge and freezer. So, you know, like...
Yeah.
I think I would have just been like, nah, man, why is that horrendous smell coming out of from your apartment? And also I'm hearing a chainsaw in the middle of the fucking night. Like, come on, bro.
Who needs a chainsaw in an apartment block?
Like, you know, just cash.
Yeah. I'm guessing he was given the death penalty.
He was beaten to death, wasn't he?
Oh, was he?
He was so he had like life in prison.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if he like had the death penalty, but he got beaten to death in prison anyway.
Yeah, I remember you saying now.
Yeah, so he was like in prison for like 2 years or something, and he just got beaten the shit out of. And
I wonder if he tried to do something to one of the other inmates, and they were like, "No, man," and beat him to death, or if maybe they found out what he'd done and they were like, "You were the lowest of the low," and beat him to death.
I think that was probably the case. I think most of them were scared because obviously I think towards the end he had been trying to like eat. I think he was trying to eat the bodies as well. So people were a bit nervous being around him. And I'm pretty sure he like tried to attack someone. I don't know if it was the person that killed him. But he didn't have a good reputation in prison either.
No,
but there's obviously more to his story, but I thought there's enough gruesome for today.
There's definitely enough gruesomeness for today. I don't think I think we get the gist actually of I'm getting bad vibes from Jeffrey Dahmer.
You don't say.
No. My spidey senses telling me to avoid him.
But I just remember like reading up about obviously Conorak when like he managed to like fucking get out of the house basically, and these officers are like, nah, like these women are just being rude and intruding for no reason.
Yeah.
And I'm like, bro.
Did you say the police also went to the apartment and they didn't notice anything?
Yeah. Well, they had a look around, but not like a proper look. So they didn't even like notice a fucking decomposing body in the bedroom. And I'm just like, why are you keeping it in the bedroom?
Yeah.
Why would you keep it in the bedroom?
You know why he's keeping it in the bedroom, Emma. This is an episode on necrophilia.
I know, but it's just like.
Yeah. I know.
No one has standards.
Yeah. Not even discover the earth. Yeah.
Like, My bedroom's like a safe haven. Like, I couldn't even imagine, like, oh.
No, yeah. Even a pile of dirty washing on the floor makes me feel uncomfortable. Let alone, I mean, I say that and my bedroom floor is currently absolutely covered in dirty washing. But
I was going to say, mine's the same as well. This is a safe haven. It's so clean. I'm like, bullshit. There's like clothes everywhere. I've got too many clothes.
Me and Eamon have not done a wash in a couple of weeks and I really need to clean some clothes now because I'm starting to run out of things that I want to wear. So what's today's lesson then?
Don't fuck a dead body.
Yeah, simple.
I don't know. I mean, obviously that, you know, that can be one of them.
Don't let a weird radiologist pressure you into building an above ground mausoleum for your daughter.
Yeah.
That's very specific.
I'm trying not to be slanderous to men, but my brain's just going, don't trust men.
Yeah. I'm not, let's not go all political about things that are going on at the moment because angry rants are not. We did that last week.
Yeah. Yeah. Just be careful.
Yeah. Stay safe.
Yeah. Make sure you've got some protection on you.
Yeah.
like a gun.
Yeah.
Well, not a gun.
No.
Yeah. Like a gun.
A knuckle duster.
A knuckle duster, yeah. Or you can get them things. You can get them in keychains and they're like got like a weighted ball at the end.
Yeah.
So say if you're being attacked and stuff, you can whack it and it can actually do enough damage for you to get away because it will shock the person.
Yeah. Actually.
If you're like proper vacuum.
No, why are these lessons we're given to women or the victims? I think the like today's lesson is like, let's go back to the beginning. Don't kill people. Don't attack people. Don't rape them when they're dead. Don't rape them when they're alive. Don't sexually assault anyone. Don't be a dick. Be kind. Leave people to live their lives. No one's like, asking for it.
Yeah. Be responsible and own up to your own actions.
Yeah.
And impulses and fantasies or whatever.
If your impulse, your impulses and fantasies are going to do damage to another person, then don't do them.
Capiche? Mic drop.
And on that bombshell.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to probably one of the most, I don't know, gory episodes yet. Please head to our Instagram. Give us a follow. It's at Gin and Spooks. We will put some photos from this episode on our Instagram and they'll also go on our blog, which is ginandspooks.wordpress.com.
If you have any drink suggestions or creepy stories of your own, please email them over to us at ginandspooks@gmail.com or send us a DM on Instagram.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.